Chapter 43. Impossible to avoid that tiny man, for there was no issue for a retreat. Another one going to that mysterious meeting, thought Razumov. He was right in his surmise, only this one, unlike the others who came from a distance, was known to him personally. Still, he hoped to pass on with a mere bow, but it was impossible to ignore the little thin hand with hairy wrist and knuckles protruded in a friendly way from under the folds of the cloak, worn Spanish-wise, in disregard of a fairly warm day, a corner flung over the shoulder. And how is Herr Razumov? Sounded the greeting in German, by that alone made more odious to the object of the affable recognition. At closer quarters the diminutive personage looked like a reduction of an ordinary sized man, with a lofty brow bared for a moment by the raising of the hat, the great pepper and salt full beard spread over the proportionally broad chest. A fine bold nose jutted over a thin mouth hidden in the mass of fine hair. All this, accented features, strong limbs in their relative smallness, appeared delicate without the slightest sign of debility. The eyes alone, almond-shaped and brown, were too big, with the whites slightly bloodshot by much pen labor under a lamp. The obscure celebrity of the tiny man was well known to Razumov. Polyglot, of unknown parentage, of indefinite nationality, anarchist, with a pedantic and ferocious temperament, and an amazingly inflammatory capacity for invective, he was a power in the background. This violent pamphleteer clamoring for revolutionary justice, this Julius Laspara, editor of the Living Word, confidant of conspirators, inditor of sanguinary menaces and manifestos, suspected of being in the secret of every plot. Laspara lived in the old town in a somber, narrow house presented to him by a naive middle-class admirer of his humanitarian eloquence. With him lived his two daughters, who overtopped him head and shoulders, and a pasty-faced, lean boy of six, languishing in the dark rooms in blue cotton overalls and clumsy boots, who might have belonged to either one of them or to neither. No stranger could tell. Julius Laspara no doubt knew which of his girls it was who, after casually vanishing for a few years, had as casually returned to him possessed of that child. But, with admirable pedantry, he had refrained from asking her for details, no, not so much as the name of the father, because maternity should be an anarchist function. Razumov had been admitted twice to that suite of several small dark rooms on the top floor. Moldy window panes, litter of all sorts of sweepings all over the place, half-full glasses of tea forgotten on every table, the two Laspara daughters prowling about enigmatically silent, sleepy-eyed, corsetless, and generally, in their want of shape and the disorder of their rumpled attire, resembling old dolls. The great but obscure Julius, his feet twisted round his three-legged stool, always ready to receive the visitors. The pen instantly dropped, the body screwed round with a striking display of the lofty brow, and of the great austere beard. When he got down from his stool it was as though he had descended from the heights of Olympus. He was dwarfed by his daughters, by the furniture, by any caller of ordinary stature. But he very seldom left it, and still more rarely was seen walking in broad daylight. It must have been some matter of serious importance which had driven him out in that direction that afternoon. Evidently he wished to be amiable to that young man whose arrival had made some sensation in the world of political refugees. In Russian now, which he spoke, as he spoke and wrote four or five other European languages, without distinction and without force other than that of invective, he inquired if Razumov had taken his inscriptions at the university as yet. And the young man, shaking his head negatively, "There's plenty of time for that. But, meantime, are you not going to write something for us?" He could not understand how anyone could refrain from writing on anything, social, economic, historical, anything. Any subject could be treated in the right spirit, and for the ends of social revolution. And, as it happened, a friend of his in London had got in touch with a review of Advanced Ideas. He must educate everybody, develop the great thought of absolute liberty, and of revolutionary justice. Razumov muttered rather surlily that he did not even know English. Write in Russian. We'll have it translated, there can be no difficulty. Why, without seeking further, there is Miss Alden. My daughters go to see her sometimes. He nodded significantly. She does nothing, has never done anything in her life. She would be quite competent, with a little assistance. Only write. You know you must. And so goodbye for the present. He raised his arm and went on. Razumov backed against the low wall, looked after him, spat violently, and went on his way with an angry mutter, "Cursed Jew!" He did not know anything about it. Julius Laspara might have been a Transylvanian, a Turk, an Andalusian, or a citizen of one of the Hanse towns for anything he could tell to the contrary. But this is not a story of the West, and this exclamation must be recorded, accompanied by the comment that it was merely an expression of hate and contempt, best adapted to the nature of the feelings Razumov suffered from at the time. He was boiling with rage, as though he had been grossly insulted. He walked as if blind, following instinctively the shore of the diminutive harbor along the quay, through a pretty, dull garden, where dull people sat on chairs under the trees, till, his fury abandoning him, he discovered himself in the middle of a long, broad bridge. He slowed down at once. To his right, beyond the toy-like jetties, he saw the green slopes framing the Petit Lac in all the marvelous banality of the picturesque made of painted cardboard, with the more distant stretch of water inanimate and shining like a piece of tin. He turned his head away from that view for the tourists, and walked on slowly, his eyes fixed on the ground. One or two persons had to get out of his way, and then turned round to give a surprised stare to his profound absorption. The insistence of the celebrated subversive journalist rankled in his mind strangely. Right. Must write. He. Right. A sudden light flashed upon him. To write was the very thing he had made up his mind to do that day. He had made up his mind irrevocably to that step, and then had forgotten all about it. That incorrigible tendency to escape from the grip of the situation was fraught with serious danger. He was ready to despise himself for it. What was it? Levity, or deep-seated weakness? Or an unconscious dread? Is it that I am shrinking? It can't be. It's impossible. To shrink now would be worse than moral suicide. It would be nothing less than moral damnation, he thought. Is it possible that I have a conventional conscience? He rejected that hypothesis with scorn, and, checked on the edge of the pavement, made ready to cross the road and proceed up the wide street facing the head of the bridge, and that for no other reason, except that it was there before him. But at the moment a couple of carriages, and a slow-moving cart interposed, and suddenly he turned sharp to the left, following the quay again, but now away from the lake. It may be just my health, he thought, allowing himself a very unusual doubt of his soundness. For, with the exception of a childish ailment or two, he had never been ill in his life. But that was a danger too. Only, it seemed as though he were being looked after in a specially remarkable way. If I believed in an act of providence, Razumov said to himself, amused grimly, I would see here the working of an ironical finger. To have a Julius Laspara put in my way, as if expressly to remind me of my purpose is right, he had said. I must, indeed. I shall write, never fear. Certainly. That's why I am here. And for the future I shall have something to write about. He was exciting himself by this mental soliloquy. But the idea of writing evoked the thought of a place to write in, of shelter, of privacy, and naturally of his lodgings, mingled with a distaste for the necessary exertion of getting there, with a mistrust, as of some hostile influence awaiting him within those odious four walls. Suppose one of these revolutionists, he asked himself, were to take a fancy to call on me while I am writing? The mere prospect of such an interruption made him shudder. One could lock one's door, or ask the tobacconist downstairs, some sort of a refugee himself, to tell inquirers that one was not in. Not very good precautions, those. The manner of his life, he felt, must be kept clear of every cause for suspicion, or even occasion for wonder, down to such trifling occurrences as a delay in opening a locked door. Wish I were in the middle of some field miles away from everywhere, he thought. He had unconsciously turned to the left once more, and now was aware of being on the bridge again. This one was much narrower than the other, and instead of being straight, made a sort of elbow or angle. At the point of that angle a short arm joined it to a hexagonal islet with a soil of gravel, and its shores faced with dressed stone, a perfection of puerile neatness. A couple of tall poplars and a few other trees stood grouped on the clean, dark gravel, and under them a few garden benches, and a bronze effigy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau seated on its pedestal. On setting his foot on it, Razumov became aware that, except for the woman in charge of the refreshment chalet, he would be alone on the island. There was something of naive, odious, and innocent simplicity about that unfrequented tiny crumb of earth named after Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Something pretentious and shabby, too. He asked for a glass of milk, which he drank standing, at one draught. Nothing but tea had passed his lips since the morning, and was going away with a weary, lagging step when a thought stopped him short. He had found precisely what he needed. If solitude could ever be secured in the open air in the middle of a town, he would have it there on this absurd island, together with the faculty of watching the only approach. He went back heavily to a garden seat, dropped into it. This was the place for making a beginning of that writing which had to be done. The materials he had on him. "She'll always come here," he said to himself, and afterwards sat for quite a long time motionless, without thought and sight and hearing, almost without life. He sat long enough for the declining sun to dip behind the roofs of the town at his back, and throw the shadow of the houses on the lakefront over the islet, before he pulled out of his pocket a fountain pen, opened a small notebook on his knee, and began to write quickly, raising his eyes now, and then at the connecting arm of the bridge. These glances were needless. The people crossing over in the distance seemed unwilling, even to look at the islet, where the exiled effigy of the author of the social contract sat enthroned above the bowed head of Razumov in the somber immobility of bronze. After finishing his scribbling, Razumov, with a sort of feverish haste, put away the pen, then rammed the notebook into his pocket, first tearing out the written pages with an almost convulsive brusqueness. But the folding of the flimsy batch on his knee was executed with thoughtful nicety. That done, he leaned back in his seat and remained motionless, the papers holding in his left hand. The twilight had deepened. He got up, and began to pace to and fro slowly under the trees. "There can be no doubt that now I am safe," he thought. His fine ear could detect the faintly accentuated murmurs of the current breaking against the point of the island, and he forgot himself in listening to them with interest. But even to his acute sense of hearing the sound was too elusive. "Extraordinary occupation I am giving myself up to," he murmured. And it occurred to him that this was about the only sound he could listen to innocently, and for his own pleasure, as it were. Yes, the sound of water, the voice of the wind completely foreign to human passions. All the other sounds of this earth brought contamination to the solitude of a soul. This was Mr. Razumov's feeling, the soul, of course, being his own, and the word being used not in the theological sense, but standing, as far as I can understand it, for that part of Mr. Razumov which was not his body, and more specially in danger from the fires of this earth. And it must be admitted, that in Mr. Razumov's case the bitterness of solitude from which he suffered, was not an altogether morbid phenomenon. Part 4. I should, at the beginning of this retrospect, mention again that Mr. Razumov's youth had no one in the world, as literally no one as it can be honestly affirmed of any human being, is but a statement of fact from a man who believes in the psychological value of facts. There is also, perhaps, a desire of punctilious fairness. Unidentified with anyone in this narrative, where the aspects of honor and shame are remote from the ideas of the Western world, and taking my stand on the ground of common humanity, it is for that very reason that I feel a strange reluctance to state boldly here what every reader has most likely already discovered himself. Such reluctance may appear absurd, if it were not for the thought that because of the imperfection of language there is always something ungracious and even disgraceful in the exhibition of naked truth. But the time has come when Counselor of State Miquelon can no longer be ignored. His simple question here too, on which we left Mr. Razumov in St. Petersburg, throws a light on the general meaning of this individual case. Whereto was the answer in the form of a gentle question to what we may call Mr. Razumov's declaration of independence. The question was not menacing in the least, and, indeed, had the ring of innocent inquiry. Had it been taken in a merely topographical sense, the only answer to it would have appeared sufficiently appalling to Mr. Razumov. Whereto? Back to his rooms, where the revolution had sought him out to put to a sudden test his dormant instincts, his half-conscious thoughts and almost wholly unconscious ambitions, by the touch, as of some furious and dogmatic religion, with its call to frantic sacrifices, its tender resignations, its dreams and hopes uplifting the soul by the side of the most somber moods of despair. And Mr. Razumov had let go the door handle, and had come back to the middle of the room, asking Counselor Miquelon angrily, "What do you mean by it?" As far as I can tell, Counselor Miquelon did not answer that question. He drew Mr. Razumov into familiar conversation. It is the peculiarity of Russian natures that, however strongly engaged in the drama of action, they are still turning their ear to the murmur of abstract ideas. This conversation, and others later on, need not be recorded. Suffice it to say, that it brought Mr. Razumov as we know him to the test of another faith. There was nothing official in its expression, and Mr. Razumov was led to defend his attitude of detachment. But Counselor Miquelon would have none of his arguments. "Or a man like you," were his last weighty words in the discussion, "such a position is impossible. Don't forget that I have seen that interesting piece of paper. I understand your liberalism. I have an intellect of that kind myself. Reform for me is mainly a question of method. But the principle of revolt is a physical intoxication, a sort of hysteria which must be kept away from the masses. You agree to this without reserve, don't you? Because, you see, Kirillo Sidorovich, abstention, reserve, in certain situations, come very near to political crime. The ancient Greeks understood that very well." Mr. Razumov, listening with a faint smile, asked Counselor Miquelon point blank if this meant that he was going to have him watched. The high official took no offense at the cynical inquiry. "No, Kirillo Sidorovich," he answered gravely. "Don't mean to have you watched." Razumov, suspecting a lie, affected yet the greatest liberty of mind during the short remainder of that interview. The older man expressed himself throughout in familiar terms, and with a sort of shrewd simplicity. Razumov concluded that to get to the bottom of that mind was an impossible feat. A great disquiet made his heart beat quicker. The high official, issuing from behind the desk, was actually offering to shake hands with him. "Goodbye, Mr. Razumov. An understanding between intelligent men is always a satisfactory occurrence. Is it not? And, of course, these rebel gentlemen have not the monopoly of intelligence. I presume that I shall not be wanted anymore?" Razumov brought out that question while his hand was still being grasped. Counselor Miquelon released it slowly. "That, Mr. Razumov," he said with great earnestness, "is as it may be. God alone knows the future. But you may rest assured that I never thought of having you watched. You are a young man of great independence. Yes. You are going away free as air, but you shall end by coming back to us. I. Razumov exclaimed in an appalled murmur of protest. Hat 4? He added feebly. Yes. You yourself, Kirill Sidorovich, the high police functionary insisted in a low, severe tone of conviction. Who shall be coming back to us? Some of our greatest minds had to do that in the end. You have no better friend than Prince K, and as to myself, it is a long time now since I've been honored by his. He glanced down his beard. I won't detain you any longer. We live in difficult times, in times of monstrous chimeras and evil dreams and criminal follies. We shall certainly meet once more. It may be some little time, though, before we do. Till then may heaven send you fruitful reflections. Once in the street, Razumov started off rapidly, without caring for the direction. At first he thought of nothing, but in a little while the consciousness of his position presented itself to him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.